Republicans hope for an orderly transition in the House, a victory in Arizona, and an exit strategy in Missouri. It's a grand old party on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. What signal is Paul Ryan sending to his fellow House Republicans by announcing his retirement in what could be a disastrous year for the GOP?
He is the leader of House Republicans, and he wants to make sure that he can do everything he can to really protect that House majority this fall, which is an endangered House majority, and I think that's a lot of his motivation.
Plus, embattled Missouri Governor Eric Greitens is feeling the heat from his own party. If he won't resign, is impeachment next?
The Senate President Pro Tem, who's the leader of the Senate in Missouri, also a Republican, went even further. And he said, it's not just that he should resign. He said, because of the severity of the allegations, it is my wish that we immediately start impeachment proceedings.
And could the GOP lose a deep red House seat next week in Arizona? They didn't think it could happen in Pennsylvania.
I think there's an anxiety among Republicans as to how this race will go. I mean, especially after they've seen this narrative develop about Democrats overperforming and in some cases Republicans letting races slip away.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 225 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. The continuous story of the week has been the Magical Mystery James Comey tour, promoting his book, A Higher Loyalty, starting with his sit-down interview on ABC Sunday night with George Stephanopoulos. The problems with Comey are well known. Accusations from both sides of the ideological aisle of grandstanding, of self-righteousness, of self-aggrandizement. Whatever you think of his decision, 11 days before the election, to say the FBI was reopening an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, there was a startling lack of understanding of its political consequences. He always seems stunned when there are suggestions that he may have made the wrong decision. But, and it's a big but, that doesn't take away the magnitude of his indictment into President Trump's conduct and behavior.
You're right that President Trump is unethical, untethered to the truth. Is Donald Trump unfit to be president?
Yes, but not in the way I often hear people talk about it. I don't buy the stuff about him being mentally incompetent or early stages of dementia. He strikes me as a person of above average intelligence who's tracking conversations and knows what's going on. I don't think he's medically unfit to be president. I think he's morally unfit to be president. Our president must embody respect and adhere to the values that are at the core of this country, the most important being truth. This president is not able to do that. He is morally unfit to be president.
For his part, Trump had been savaging Comey on Twitter before and after the interview aired, calling him a slime ball, a leaker, a liar, the worst FBI director in history. Comey expanded on his concerns Tuesday night on CBS's The Late Show with Stephen Colbert.
My first reaction to those kind of tweets is a shrug, like, oh, there he goes again. But actually then I caught myself and I said, wait a minute, if I'm shrugging, are the rest of the country shrugging? And does that mean we become numb to this? It's not okay for the president of the United States to say a private citizen should be in jail. It's not normal, it's not acceptable, it's not okay. But it's happened so much, there's a danger, we're now numb to it and the norm has been destroyed. And I feel that norm destroying in my own shrug. And so we can't allow that to happen. We have to talk about it and call it out. It's not okay.
Trump has other worries as well. The FBI raid on the home and businesses of Michael Cohen, his lawyer and fixer, continue to rattle. The potential for damaging information from Cohen's files and phones have to be just as concerning as whatever Robert Mueller uncovers. And Cohen's appearance in court has shaken another Trump sycophant, Fox News host Sean Hannity. Hannity has long been a defender of Trump, and he was clearly upset and angered at what happened to Cohen.
All right, tonight we have an explosive new chapter in Mueller's partisan witch hunt. Now, we have now entered a dangerous new phase, and there's no turning back from this. It is clear, as I have been warning, Mueller is out to get the president, and it appears at any cost. Here's what happened. Upon referral from Special Counselor Robert Mueller, the FBI has raided the office, the home, and the hotel room of Michael Cohen, the personal attorney of the President of the United States. This is now officially an all-hands-on-deck effort to totally malign and, if possible, impeach the President of the United States.
But on Monday, when Cohen appeared in court, he was told to reveal the names of his clients. There was a total of three, and the third one was Sean Hannity, a fact Hannity never revealed during his pro-Trump, pro-Cohen rants on Fox. Meanwhile, both parties found something on Tuesday that they agreed on. Too bad it was regarding sad news. Barbara Bush, the wife of a president and the mother of another president, died at the age of 92. Just the day before, it was announced that because she was in failing health, she would not seek additional medical treatment. The next day, she was gone. She is now at peace. Our thoughts and prayers to President Bush and the entire Bush family. Barbara Pierce and George Bush were married 73 years, the longest love story in the history of presidential marriages. Here she is at the 1988 Republican National Convention in New Orleans.
You know, I've loved George Bush almost since the day I laid eyes on him.
And in 2011, on the Today Show, with their granddaughter, Jenna Bush Hager, as a correspondent, George was reading some of the love letters he sent to Barbara during World War II. He ended by reading one he sent in 1994.
January 6, 1994. For Barbara Pierce from GHWB. Will you marry me? Oops, I forgot you did that 49 years ago today. I was very happy on that day in 1945, but I'm even happier today. You give me joy that few men know. I've climbed perhaps the highest mountain in the world, but even that cannot hold a candle to being Barbara's husband. Mom used to tell me, now, George, don't walk ahead.
You never listened to your mother.
Little did I know I was only trying to keep up with Barb Pierce from Onondaga Street in Rye, New York. Oh, I love you.
I love you, too.
An amazing love story. That leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last first lady born in the same hometown as her husband? Send your answer to trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia@krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
When a man loves a woman, can't keep his mind on nothing else. He changed the world for the good thing he found. If she is bad, he can see it. She can do no wrong. Turn him back on his best friend if he put her down. When a man loves a woman, spend his very last dime trying to hold on to what he needs. He give up all his comforts and sleep out in the rain.
The announcement by Speaker Paul Ryan that he will not seek re-election has been interpreted by some that he's getting out in advance of what may be a disastrous year for House Republicans. That if the Republicans were to lose control of the House in November, there would have been a mutiny against his leadership anyway, so why not leave now? Or at least before the election. With the filing deadline in some 15 states yet to come, Ryan's move may lead to other Republicans deciding that maybe 2018 is not the year to run. Quite a few senior Republicans, committee chairs, and others have already announced their retirement. And with Ryan insisting on staying on as Speaker through the end of the year, House Republicans will be led by a lame duck whose odds of passing meaningful legislation before the midterm elections have shrunk considerably. Sungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post, As she describes it, she covers the Trump administration through the lens of Capitol Hill. Sangmin, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thrilled that you're here, and I have a bunch of questions for you because it's just a fast-moving and fascinating story. In the past, when Republican speakers decided they wanted to leave, they left. I mean, John Boehner, when he was unable to fight a conservative rebellion, he quit in October of 2015. When Newt Gingrich, his strategy of running against Clinton and Lewinsky blew up in his face after 1998, he quit right after the election, and he, you know, right after he was reelected. Why is Ryan staying on?
I think he's staying on because clearly he has committed to doing so until through basically the end of his term in January. And I do think he feels a little bit of an obligation to the House Republican conference that he's leaving. Clearly he is the top fundraiser for the party. He is quite a draw. He is the leader of House Republicans, and he wants to make sure that he can do everything he can to really protect that House majority this fall, which is an endangered House majority. And I think that's a lot of his motivation. I think we weren't surprised when Speaker Ryan said this term would be his last in Congress. We had been getting kind of hints of that for months, and there have been several stories on that matter. But I really do think that he feels this, he does really feel this obligation to see through that House Republicans can protect their majority this November.
But we talk about him being a great fundraiser, and he has been a great fundraiser during his years as Speaker. But now that he's lame duck, now that he's obviously no longer going to run for, you know, be Speaker after this year, is his ability to raise money, you think it's as could be as successful as it has been in the past?
I think that's something that we're going to be really watching over these next couple of months as these quarter fundraising reports come in, and we see if Speaker Ryan can remain that high wattage fundraiser that he is right now. And immediately after his retirement announcement, there were some numbers that showed his fundraising ability was still very high. And what the Speaker has been telling members and telling us is that perhaps he has more time now that he's not focused on his own reelection bid back in Janesville, Wisconsin, that he would have more time to, you know, do a kind of a one last hurrah and raise that money for this House majority. So it could particularly be a benefit. But I think it's something that we really do have to wait and see. You know, what we've been hearing from House Republicans, some House Republicans, is that it may be difficult for the Speaker to stay on. I mean, people do want to be invested in someone who's going to be in there for the long haul. So there is a question. I mean, and this question seems to have died down a little bit in the last few days, but there have been questions about how long he could really stick around and whether he does have that fundraising staying power.
Well, the moment he announced it, all eyes went to two obvious candidates, Kevin McCarthy, the House Majority Leader, and Steve Scalise, the Majority Whip, as likely Ryan's successors. Scalise has since said he won't challenge McCarthy, and Ryan himself has endorsed McCarthy. Does that make Kevin McCarthy the likely winner, or might there still be another candidate or three who get in the race?
We have to wait and see. Clearly, right now, Kevin McCarthy does have the advantage, having the blessing of the current speaker and having Steve Scalise saying that he would support him once he does decide to make that run. But you have to remember there's a little wrinkle in the race right now, and that wrinkle is named Jim Jordan. He's a congressman from Ohio, a Republican, and he has been a past leader of the House Freedom Caucus, which is this conservative bloc of House members who've really been a thorn in the side of House Republican leadership on policy, on, you know, House strategy and things like that. And we know, I mean, just from watching this House Republican conference, we know that Jim Jordan does not have a chance of being the next Republican leader, whether it's for Speaker or as House Minority Leader. He just simply does not have the votes. But what he does have and what the rest of the Freedom Caucus has is leverage. Remember that to become Speaker, you have to win 218 votes on the House floor. And how that differs is if you're just going to be the House Minority Leader, it's an internal election. You have to win just half of your conference. And there is no doubt that Kevin McCarthy can win, you know, at least 50% of support from the House conference. But can he lock down 218 votes on the House floor?
You're saying 218, which is half of the full House membership.
Correct. And remember, back in 2015, he failed to do that because people like Jim Jordan and the House Freedom Caucus were denying him votes. So Jim Jordan and the conservative bloc of members, they could really extract some demands from Kevin McCarthy here in, you know, whether it's committee chairmanships or other kind of concessions that would give them more influence if they want McCarthy to win their vote.
You refer to 2015. That's the time when Boehner quit and McCarthy was considered the front runner. I remember during that race, he made some dumb mistakes. He talked about Hillary Clinton and the Benghazi committee, which was a disaster. There were some rumors about his personal life. There were some conservatives, mostly in the Freedom Caucus, as you point out, who felt he wasn't conservative enough. So, of course, he didn't run. He dropped out, and that's how we got Paul Ryan. But are we seeing a new Kevin McCarthy, or are some of the concerns that conservatives had about him in 2015, are they still there?
I think there's a definite new factor in Kevin McCarthy as a conservative leader this time around that did not exist in 2015, and that factor is called Donald Trump. We have Kevin McCarthy has been very close to the president and been a major ally of the administration on policy, on strategy, on messaging, on mapping out what they're going to do to keep the majority in this year's midterms. They're so close that the president calls McCarthy my Kevin, and they have a very close relationship. And that relationship has given McCarthy a chance to prove to others in his conference over and over that he does have this, you know, highly influential factor, and that he is so close to Trump and that he can get things done and he can kind of shore up his conservative credentials in that manner.
Does it help or hurt McCarthy's chances that the election is still 8 or 9 months away? Wouldn't it be better for him if the election were held now?
I think it would be, because he's a leading person who has the support of the conference. But, you know, there's a problem that Speaker Ryan does not want to leave, and he has made it clear he does not want to leave. The more time that this drags on, the more time that Jim Jordan and the likes of Jim Jordan have to strategize against what kind of concessions they want to secure from McCarthy, and for that opposition perhaps to build. And, some Republicans initially, when the Speaker made his surprise announcement last week, said that, you know, it might be easier for us to kind of just put this to bed and know what our leadership team looks like after November, you know, with all due respect to the Speaker. So clearly getting it out of the way, in my perspective, would help Kevin McCarthy now, but that doesn't seem to be likely at this point in time.
Well, that leads to this question. We're not going to know the answer until November. My question was, will the winner of the contest to succeed Ryan be the next Speaker or the House Minority Leader? And if the Republican Party loses the House, might that be an argument, up ahead in November or December, an argument for Republicans to vote for a change from the current leadership?
That is definitely some of the arguments that we have heard from House Republicans who have said, let's keep all this leadership drama until after November 2018. I believe it was Congressman Peter King, a Republican of New York, who said, maybe we'll get a message in these midterm elections that will help us guide who that new leader should be. And that is also a very valid argument that the GOP conference is struggling with internally. But it is one of many factors that have to be figured out. Clearly, there are some who would prefer an earlier election, but there is a point to be made that, you know, we'll have to see what the voters tell us in terms of what kind of leadership we want at the top in the House Republican Conference.
Speaker Ryan has shown that he has had difficulties battling with the Freedom Caucus conservatives. Of course, that's what forced Boehner around. Boehner couldn't deal with them at all. Is Kevin McCarthy the guy who can deal with them? Or another question, is there anyone who could unite the party?
Well, I mean, clearly, when he tried to get the votes for Speaker last time 3 years ago, he couldn't, and that is why we have a Speaker Ryan in the first place. He, as you remember, Paul Ryan really was the reluctant Speaker who stepped in when no one else could get the votes. The Freedom Caucus is not a shy bloc of conservatives. They know how to leverage the leverage that they have. They know how to make their demands. Clearly, they're not afraid to be a thorn in the side of House Republican leadership. So, I mean, as long as there is a Freedom Caucus and they're committed to their principles and to their ideals, I think they will be that bloc who will always keep whoever is at the top of the Republican leadership ranks, you know, keep them in check. And that is why perhaps if you get an actual Freedom Caucus member as a member of leadership, how much those dynamics would change, because that could be something else that the Freedom Caucus demands from Kevin McCarthy to be able to win over their block of votes, to have one of their own actually at the leadership table when the speaker and his leadership ranks gather to strategize. And that could be something that they seek, certainly.
Let me ask you a quick question about the Democrats. Conor Lamb's victory in that special Pennsylvania election last month reminds me that not every Democrat loves Nancy Pelosi. If the Democrats win a majority in the House, and the odds probably now say that they may, very well may, is Pelosi certain to become the speaker once again?
I think that is another really great question that we'll be watching in the next several months. Clearly, Pelosi has shown no signs that she is going anywhere away from the top of the House Democratic ranks. I mean, we're talking about how good of a fundraiser Speaker Ryan is. So is Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi works hard, travels across the country to raise money to win back the House majority for Democrats. And while the anti-Pelosi faction has been making noise for a long time, especially from this younger generation of House members who are really eager for new faces in the Democratic leadership, she's saying, look, I am not going anywhere, and I don't see any signs that she's going anywhere either. But you do have to remember that there are Democratic candidates who are campaigning. They're not necessarily campaigning against her, but they will say on the campaign trail that I will not vote for Nancy Pelosi to be my leader. And one of them happened to be Conor Lamb, who won that surprise election in Pennsylvania last month.
Let me ask you one final question that is probably more impossible to answer than anything else I've asked you so far. But I remember Paul Ryan in 2016 speaking skeptically about Donald Trump as being a candidate, you know, during the campaign. And he said some critical things about him. And a lot of people thought that once Trump was elected and in office, Ryan would still have that kind of independence. That really didn't happen. Do you see any possibility that in the remaining months we'll see a new, more independent Ryan, you know, one that tries to protect his colleagues from the excesses of Trump? Of course, As I'm asking that question, the alternative is that are the members of his party, or at least the ones that are running again, are they sticking with the president more than ever and make such an independent Ryan impossible to imagine?
I think that's a really great question, and that's something that we're going to be watching in the coming months, as well as many of these other factors. Because I think there were kind of high expectations set on Ryan by these critics of the president, thinking that the speaker, who clearly was not afraid to speak out against Trump and his rhetoric when he was a campaign for president, that he would be more of that check on Trump once he was inaugurated and once he was in the White House. And I know a lot of these Trump critics had been disappointed in the speaker. And whether the fact that he's leaving Congress in the coming months frees him more to speak out against, I have not seen evidence of that yet. Clearly, the speaker and the president, along with Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, they all work hand in glove to try to accomplish a lot of these policy actions, the new tax law being one of them. But we see that the speaker has been willing to push back a little bit when it comes to things that the administration does that he disagrees with. One of the best examples of that is the tariff policy of this administration, with Paul Ryan being such a, you know, ardent pro free trade Republican. But, you know, if there is another kind of a volley in this trade fight, we'll see how forcefully the speaker chooses to weigh in. But I think, you know, just a week after his shock announcement, it's a little bit too soon to gauge how independent he's going to be of the White House right now.
Sungmin Kim covers the White House and Capitol Hill for The Washington Post. Sungmin, it was wonderful having you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How can I just let you walk away? Just let you leave without a trace? When I stand here taking every breath with you. Ooh, you're the only one who really knew me at all.
Like President Trump, Missouri Governor Eric Greitens came into office in 2017 as an outsider. Like Trump, his style and brashness won him an unlikely victory. And like Trump, he didn't have a long history with the Republican Party, and thus got into some early scraps with GOP leaders. And also like Trump, he now finds himself in big trouble that has to do with a sex scandal that began before he was elected. But unlike Trump, his fellow Republicans are among those leading the call for him to resign. Brian Ellison is a reporter with station KCUR in Kansas City and joins us now. Brian, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Good to be with you again.
Well, here's what we know. I mean, we already knew that the governor was accused by his hairdresser for groping her, blindfolding her, forcing her to have oral sex with him, and, as if this wasn't bad enough, photographing her naked without her consent and hoping to use the pictures for protection to keep her from telling anyone about what happened. Those are her accusations against him.
Is that all?
Exactly right. This all occurred in 2015, before he was elected, and we've known about it for a few months. We had you on the show talking about that a few months ago. But something has changed this week. Tell me what's the new stuff?
Well, if I can, let me start by going back to last week. We knew the general outline of what you just described. What we did not know were sort of the salacious details. We didn't know until a House Investigative Committee report came out last week that, for example, a number of those acts were, in her view, non-consensual. She was deemed a credible witness by this House committee, which is 5 Republicans and 2 Democrats. And they published a report that ran to about 400 pages, including all of the transcripts of her very, very graphic descriptions of what happened with her, which includes, as you say, being undressed, being kissed while her hands were bound. The oral sex that you described took place in the context of her lying on the floor crying and saying she didn't want this. It was the response to those salacious details and the extent of those accusations that led an ever-growing number of lawmakers to say, okay, enough is enough. It's really time for him to resign. And if he doesn't, to face impeachment. This week, it got even more complicated for the governor. The attorney general came out and said that in the course of investigating how a donor list from the charity that Greitens founded back in 2007, The Mission Continues, it's a charity to support veterans who have returned from combat, somehow the donor list from the charity got in the hands of Greitens' gubernatorial campaign. Now, we knew that already, too. That came out a year ago. The Missouri Ethics Commission fined the campaign. They paid the fine. What we didn't know until this week when the attorney general announced it is that the governor himself is apparently personally implicated in the obtaining and the use of that list. And so the new development is that that matter, the evidence in that matter, has been given to the local prosecutor, which, as it turns out, is the same St. Louis City Circuit Attorney, Kim Gardner, who is already prosecuting the governor on the invasion of privacy charge.
And this is the attorney general who probably would not like to be in this position to begin with, considering he's the likely Republican nominee for the Senate against Claire McCaskill this year.
Well, yes, that's what makes this exceptionally complicated. Josh Hawley he was elected in the same election as the governor less than 2 years ago, said that he was not climbing the ladder, did not intend to run for other offices, and yet found himself almost immediately recruited as a potential challenger to Claire McCaskill. He is the leading Republican candidate, has been embraced by the establishment, endorsed by President Trump for that office, and has come under a lot of pressure to investigate the governor, not just on these matters, but also on other things, on transparency in the governor's office, on the governor's use of an app that destroys text messages after they're sent, and whether he may be violating state sunshine laws. And time and again, Hawley has come in for criticism that he's not pursuing the governor strongly enough. So this week, he's gone the other direction and indeed has come under criticism by some that he's being politically opportunistic, that this is a way to distance himself from an increasingly unpopular governor.
Let me go back to the governor's reaction. You laid out the case against him, the charges, the allegations made by his former hairdresser, and also the other allegations that Attorney General Hawley is looking into. But how has the governor responded?
Well, his response has been consistently the same, that he is the victim of a, quote, political witch hunt. At times, he has connected the actions of the circuit attorney in St. Louis, who is a former Democratic lawmaker. He's connected her to George Soros, the boogeyman who supports all liberal politicians, apparently. He has suggested that this whole thing will be cleared up when it goes to trial. That gets to be a harder case to make, that this is a Democratic witch hunt against him, when all of the charges here are coming from the Republican Attorney General or from the Republicans who lead both the Missouri House and Senate. Increasingly, he finds himself isolated. But the other consistent part of his response, Ken, has been what he said in a tweet right after House and Senate leaders called on him to resign. He said, "I will not be resigning the governor's office. In 3 weeks, this matter will go to a court of law where it belongs." He said, "Until then, I will do what the people of Missouri sent me here to do, to serve them and work hard on their behalf."
Well, you mentioned his response. Let me play a part of it. To me, it sounds a little Trump-like. Let's give it a listen.
"I want to say again what I've said from the beginning. This is a political witch hunt. I made a personal mistake. I engaged in a consensual relationship with a woman who is not my wife. It was a private mistake that I regret every day, that has nothing to do with governing and shouldn't be about politics. But people are turning that personal mistake into a political spectacle and telling new lies about it."
Brian, there's going to be a criminal trial next month, as you say, and he expects to be exonerated. Do you expect him to still be in office by then?
Well, you know, my views on that question have changed over time. I certainly think he believes right now that he will still be in office until then. Governor Greitens is nothing if not a fighter. As he often reminds people, he's a former Navy SEAL, and that instinct has certainly stuck with him as he has carried out the office of governor. Having said that, the pressure is growing pretty intense. This week, after the Attorney General's press conference, the House Speaker, the Speaker Pro Tem, the House Majority Leader issued a statement that said, "We believe
all
of the power players in Missouri are Republicans, and they have come out and said, we believe the governor needs to take responsibility for his actions. In our view, the time has come for the governor to resign." And I'll tell you, the Senate President Pro Tem, who's the leader of the Senate in Missouri, also a Republican, went even further. And he said, it's not just that he should resign. He said, "Because of the severity of the allegations, it is my wish that we immediately start impeachment proceedings," which is pretty strong language. That's the highest ranking official so far to say impeachment should begin now.
Tell me, what does impeachment entail? I know that no Missouri governor has ever been impeached and removed from office, but what would the legislature have to do? What would the process be for impeachment?
So the process, of course, starts in the House, just as it does in the federal government. Right now, there is this investigating committee, which has been given additional powers to make recommendations regarding discipline, which up to and including possible impeachment. So they would bring articles of impeachment. They would have to be approved by the House, a simple majority of the House. That amounts to an accusation of the governor. Now, unlike in the federal system, the Senate does not actually sit as the jury for an impeachment trial in Missouri. And when it's the governor who's the subject of the impeachment proceeding, the Senate is charged with naming a group of seven, quote, eminent jurists. And by statute, it's been defined that those are basically elected or appointed judges from around the state. It can be from the appellate courts or from county courts. And they choose seven judges who sit as the jury, who then must make a decision about whether to remove the governor.
Going back to the Josh Hawley in the Senate race, I hate to put this in political terms because obviously we're talking about potential crimes here, but the Claire McCaskill seat has long been thought of as a potential pickup for the Republican Party. And I know at the same time, Hawley has been, you know, has joined in the call for Greitens to quit. Would it be in Hawley's best interest if Greitens were gone sooner than later?
It seems like maybe it would, and here's why. The every day, the news cycle in Missouri is being dominated by this Greitens story. Every day, Josh Hawley is scrutinized on whether he is being tough enough, or by some aspects of the Republican base, too tough on the governor. I think if this is treated as simply a Republican versus Democrat race without those complications, Hawley stands in very good stead. McCaskill is going to have a very difficult time winning in a state where Trump won by 19 points. So Hawley would like to get the Greitens issue off of the plate entirely. Having said that, I think he's being very politically savvy by distancing himself from the governor right now. If the governor should be removed from office one way or another, although the lieutenant governor would become the governor, I think there's a very real sense in which Josh Hawley will be seen as the leader of the state party at that point, especially as he's engaged in a statewide campaign against Claire McCaskill. So it could actually be a very good situation for him.
I can't help think but the kind of luck that Claire McCaskill has had in her opponents. Remember, 6 years ago, the Republican candidate was Todd Akin and his famous comment that you couldn't get pregnant from legitimate rape. Let me play this piece of that tape.
If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down.
That was the end of Todd Akin, wasn't it?
It sure was. And of course, we remember that Claire McCaskill, also an incredibly savvy politician, supported Todd Akin getting the Republican nomination. He was the one she wanted to run against.
She singled him out, right?
Exactly. And so she played that exactly right. And after he made those statements, Claire McCaskill was very quick to the airwaves with ads from women saying, I'm a Republican. I've never voted for a Democrat in my life, but I can't support someone who says the things Todd Akin said. Now, I don't know how she's going to play this when Josh Hawley is her opponent. He's a little more squeaky clean, I think, in terms of his background. At least that's the perception. But I imagine Claire McCaskill is watching and waiting for the right moment to use all this to her advantage.
Well, already the Democrats are trying to link Hawley with the unpopular governor. And here's a little piece of tape from that ad.
Governor Eric Greitens has been indicted.
Scandals in Jefferson City. Now real questions about Attorney General Josh Hawley. He took nearly $3 million from a single donor accused of an illegal pay-to-play scheme with lawmakers. But Josh Hawley.
You know, I think that's an interesting ad. The reference there to that donor is David Humphreys, who also was a major donor, a Joplin businessman, to Eric Greitens. But Humphreys has called on Greitens to resign, and none of those pay-for-play allegations were ever taken to court or proven. I think the other issue that I think folks are raising with Josh Hawley and his investigation here is that this investigation of the charity, and realize that wasn't necessarily a criminal investigation at the beginning. It's part of the Attorney General's jurisdiction to supervise nonprofit organizations in the state. But that investigation's been going on for quite a while. Why are these charges, or the suggestion that there should be charges, coming out now? In Hawley's press conference, he said it's because the statute of limitations is approaching quickly for charges to be filed. But a lot of people are suggesting that Hawley needed to find something to point to show that he was independent of the governor, and this is what he found.
Before I let you go, I think of this tagline from a Greitens ad 2 years ago. I want to play it.
Eric Greitens is more than a conservative patriot. With the vision, the resolve, and the heart Missouri needs. He's the governor we deserve.
Brian, the governor we deserve. What do you say to that?
Don't we always get the elected leaders we deserve, Ken? Yeah, I think, Governor Greitens' problems with a lot of the establishment Missouri began long before these allegations. From the time he took office, in fact, from before he took office, his campaign themes were about draining the swamp, about battling, quote, corrupt career politicians. He has been sounding that horn throughout. His first term with the legislature, he tried to bully legislators into taking his political positions. That sometimes worked and it sometimes didn't. But he left himself without very many friends on either side of the aisle. And so did we get the governor we deserve? I guess that'll be up to the voters and perhaps some jurors in St. Louis and maybe an impeachment panel in Jefferson City to decide.
Brian Ellison is an unimpeachable reporter with radio station KCUR in Kansas City. Brian, it was great having you on the program.
Thanks again, Ken.
We've already said goodbye. Since you gotta go, hurry
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last House Speaker to announce his retirement but serve out his final term? The answer, Tip O'Neill. The Massachusetts Democrat succeeded Carl Albert as Speaker in 1977 and served until his retirement 10 years later. And the winner is Steve Flick of St. Louis, Missouri. Steve wins the coveted Political Junkie button. The new Scuttle Button puzzle is up. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Tiptoe through the window, by the window, that's where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Among the members of Congress caught up in sexual harassment scandals is Trent Franks. An 8-term Republican from Arizona, Franks stepped down in December following complaints from two women in his office who said Franks proposed using them as surrogates because he and his wife suffered from infertility. Franks is a strong social conservative who often cited the Bible and denounced abortion. He had long been considered a potential Senate candidate and, in fact, considered challenging John McCain in 2010. But now he's gone. The special election to replace him is on Tuesday. The 8th District, which encompasses the northwest suburbs of Phoenix, is solidly Republican and normally wouldn't merit much interest from the two parties, let alone the media. But that's what they said about the solidly Republican seat in southwest Pennsylvania, the one Democrat Connor Lamb won last month in an upset. That seat was also vacant because of the resignation of a Republican incumbent caught in a sexual harassment scandal. Ron Hansen has been covering the race for the Arizona Republic and joins us now. Ron, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken. It's good to chat.
Well, thanks for being here. And, you know, before we say goodbye to forever to Trent Franks, tell us a little bit about what he was like as a congressman. Very conservative seems to be a fair description.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely was conservative and often hard to reach. He kept kind of a low profile by design. He did his work in Washington and other things, evidently, and really didn't draw a heck of a lot of attention to himself. He was a member of the Freedom Caucus and a staunch conservative, occasionally popped up with a gaffe that would make a blip on the national radar screen and then go back into obscurity. This sort of early end to his political career sort of caught a lot of us off guard and is everything that his career was not in many ways.
Yeah, I was going to say that for the most part, for the longest time, we thought that he'd be looking to challenge McCain again or run in a special election to succeed McCain or to run to succeed Jeff Flake. But obviously, that doesn't look like it's happening in the cards anytime soon.
That's right. I would say his political career is on ice for the moment.
Tell us about the two women who are running to replace him. There's Debbie Lesko, the Republican, and Harold Tippernenny, the Democrat.
That's right. So what we have is Debbie Lesko is a former state senator. She's been in the legislature here for about 9 years and has been really kind of associated with things like school choice and a pretty consistent, predictable conservative in the state legislature. She's been active in the West Valley and from the PTA on up to the state legislature for off and on 20 years. Her opponent is a political novice this is kind of her first foray into these sorts of things. She is a physician turned cancer research advocate, Dr. Harold Tippernenny, and she's really kind of part of this crop of Democratic recruits that is kind of getting out there and offering a new voice, new perspective on the issues of the day.
Well, I was looking at the ads from the two candidates, and it seems like they're obviously coming from completely different perspectives. Let me play a Debbie Lesko ad first.
Our southern border is a war zone. Illegal immigrants cross our border, ignoring our laws. That's why I support President Trump's plan to build the wall. But that's not enough. We need more Border Patrol agents and the best technology to stop this invasion.
The LESCO plan?
Build the wall, more agents, the best technology. I'm Debbie LESCO. I approve this message because border security is national security.
And the Tipper Nanny ad I'm going to play that right now sounded much more negative.
Don't be fooled by politician Debbie LESCO.
Together, we are going to make America great again. Woo-hoo!
A federal investigation into illegal money laundering, a pledge to cut Social Security, a huge APS rate hike. The lobbyists are thrilled. There's a better choice for Congress. Dr. Hiral Tippernetti, ER physician, not a politician, a problem solver who will clean up Washington. Tippernetti's on our side.
I'm Dr. Hiral Tippernetti, and I approve this message.
We're talking about two completely different approaches here, at least in these two ads.
Yeah, it really has been sort of two very different approaches in this race since we've pivoted from the primaries. Debbie Lesko's really kind of leaned in on the idea of being supportive of the president and his agenda, especially as it relates to border security, the wall, and immigration. She has taken fairly predictable stances on these issues in line with where the White House is and frankly in line with where a lot of the Republicans who make up much of this district are at as well. This is an issue that plays well to the older voters that are concerned about border security and just changing complexion almost literally of Arizona and the U.S. They're worried about illegal immigration as something that is kind of reshaping America in a way they don't like, and Debbie is embracing that kind of posture and has done it in a way that at times has been rhetorically sharper than the president even, as it relates, for example, on the DACA issue. Debbie Lesko said that she would not support citizenship for these children brought into the country by their parents or others. She would be willing to support legal status, but she thinks that Donald Trump has gone further than she would like to go on that.
Is President Trump an issue in this race? Does he retain popularity and a strong popularity in this conservative district?
The president is very popular among Republicans in this district, and he is, as always, sort of casting a shadow over everything in the political stratosphere, it seems. Hiral Tippernetti, the Democrat, is not afraid of talking about him, but he's not the central line of attack. It's not the central message to voters. She's much more aggressive about talking about Paul Ryan and budget cuts and program cuts to things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. That's the line of attack that she reaches for first. Invariably, it does come around to Donald Trump. And she is kind of trying to, circle the square here. She says that she has agreed with him at times on certain issues. The problem is the president is hard to narrow down to a single position on any issue. And where she finds common ground, he often departs it within days. So she has not been attacking Donald Trump per se. She's really trying to go after the congressional Republicans and especially talking about things like health care.
I read in one of your reports that the Republicans have been pouring in money that seems to suggest they're nervous about the outcome. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's an anxiety among Republicans as to how this race will go. I mean, especially after what happened in Pennsylvania, Alabama, and some of the other races that they've seen this kind of narrative develop about Democrats overperforming and in some cases Republicans letting races slip away that probably would have gone theirs in a more normal cycle. There's an anxiety here that they want to make sure that that doesn't happen. Democrats, though, it should be noted, have really not invested in this race, which is kind of curious. If the race were truly a jump ball, you would expect to see more Democratic money flowing in.
What are you hearing from voters?
It's kind of a two-track discussion. I think that among the real conservatives in the district, you hear people talk about things like border security and immigration. It really is sort of, in many ways, the audience that the president won over here statewide 2 years ago. But among younger folks in particular, they're far more interested in things like health care and the economy and trying to secure a more stable future. So, you know, these candidates have taken very different approaches, very different messaging, and they're really kind of playing to what they think is a base. The question is for the Democrats whether there's enough of them and enough independents who might be willing to cross over.
You know, we talk about all the enthusiasm that Democrats have around the country and the less enthusiasm coming from the Republicans. But if we're talking about a district where there are so far fewer Democrats than there are Republicans, and the enthusiasm factor may not prove to be important.
Yeah, and I should note, Arizona is one of the states that's pretty aggressive about early voting. People vote by mail here and have been for a few weeks in this race. We see the daily updates as far as where these ballots have come from in terms of the partisan registration. The Republican balloting that has been submitted so far, they have a 20-point lead over the Democrats in terms of the numbers of ballots turned in from registered Republicans compared to registered Democrats. And the turnout, just comparing that to the universe of Republicans and Democrats in the race, right now shows Republicans with a small lead over Democrats in terms of just turnout. So forget the ballots, just the turnout levels. It looks like Republican enthusiasm is matching, if not exceeding, the Democrats to this moment. We still haven't seen the final numbers on this, so a lot could change. But one thing, again, that is kind of interesting is that the Republican turnout in volume and in percentage suggests that the GOP is taking this fairly seriously.
And what does your gut tell you is going to happen on Tuesday?
You know, look, you have to think Lesko's going to win this race. The real question is whether she wins it by a lot. It seems like, you know, 10 to 15 points, that's an acceptable range for her. It would be underperforming a bit, but that's a solid win. For Democrats, if you can get it, you know, south of 10, boy, that's going to feel like you accomplished something pretty significant in a district that you haven't even run a candidate in 6 years.
And then that would lead to the obvious question. If the Democrats lose by only a few percentage points, they'll be criticized for not investing more heavily into the race.
There's always something to second guess, right?
Right, that's right. Ron Hansen is a political reporter for the Arizona Republic and has been covering next Tuesday's special election in the state's 8th Congressional District. Ron, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze and listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in.
Before we go, some sad news. Carl Castle, the longtime NPR personality whose career spanned from a serious newscaster to a fun-loving straight man sidekick on the network's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me program, died Tuesday. He was 84 years old and had been in failing health. To many of us, it was his voice that greeted us early in the morning with the news of the day, sometimes good, sometimes awful.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carl Castle. Details are sketchy, but it appears that a plane has crashed into the upper floors of the World Trade Center in New York City. There have been broadcast reports that a plane had struck it. CNN is quoting a witness as saying that it was a twin-engine plane that flew right into the Trade Center. Witnesses do report hearing a huge explosion, and heavy smoke can be seen billowing from the building at the moment.
That, of course, was the morning of September 11th, 2001. But it was away from the newscast booth where one really got to know Carl. He had this devilishly dried sense of humor, a passion for baseball. He was always humble and kind and delightful, a warm, genuine human being. I never got his voice on my answering machine, but I do have the recording of him announcing my score when I was a guest on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
So, Carl, how much of a hometown boy is our very own Ken Rudin?
Well, with two correct answers, Peter, he's a studs of a hometown boy, meaning that Jason Arnold wins our prize.
Great. That's, before you get excited, Ked, that's Studs, not Stud. Named, of course, for Studs Terkel, who came on and got two right. So congratulations.
This actually, this sounds funny, but this was the greatest day of my life.
I'm filled with both admiration and pity. I don't know what to say.
I'm sorry to learn we lost him at age 84. He was a genuine treasure. Rest in peace, my friend.
Now it's time to say good night.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to join us next week on The Political Junkie for part two of our three-part series, 1968, 50 years later. We'll go back to August of that year and recall the disastrous Democratic convention in Chicago, including the turmoil inside the hall and the violent protests out on the streets. You can find out more about the series on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Sweet.